got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here as always. Kevin, what's going on?
Nothing much. Just stretching fence.
Stretching fence.
Yeah. It sounds more exciting than it really is.
Well, I don't know. It sounds like a manly outdoor project. So that's always nice.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those things that at 95 degrees Fahrenheit is only a greater challenge, but we've got a significant amount of property that's got valuable crops growing on it, and we've been seeing a few deer walking around, so I got to protect some stuff with some higher fence, and it's a good time. You know, just a lot of work and a lot of fun, novel tools, so, and cement and really big poles. So good times.
Well, look at you. You're building fences. I made a baby that's going to be here very shortly. So we both have very crazy lives right now is what it sounds like.
Yeah, that's right. The difference is that mine will sleep well through the night. And I won't need to change it for 30 years.
Yeah, dude. You know, that I'm not looking forward to that because they go through a lot of diapers, let's say. So,
yeah. Well, you could just never use a diaper. I had a friend who they just let their kid walk around with no diaper, and he would just drop a deuce right on the floor, and then they just hose it off.
You know, I don't want to replace my floors though, so I'm gonna go with the diapers.
No, this was outside. They let him go outside in the yard. I thought it was so weird.
I just don't think my wife would go for that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I get it. This was a pure convenience move for this couple. They would just let him run loose and he'd just do it. And, you know, and then they'd just hose it off.
Well, different strokes.
Yeah, hey, cool.
Well, anyways, with that helpful insight out of the way, let's jump into our stories for the day. So first up, vaccines and autism, how Hollywood fame and fortune can lead to dangerous promotion of false cures, false causes, and false hopes. Next up, top U.S. researchers concluded last spring that the Wuhan COVID lab leak theory was plausible and should actually be seriously investigated. And then finally, Africa cracks down on locust swarms by ignoring Greenpeace's anti-pesticide rhetoric. So interesting, I may even say incendiary stories today, Kevin. So let's jump into this first one. Tell us about vaccines and autism.
Yeah, incendiary. So this was an important one, though, because it goes back to looking through the history of the folks who have really promoted bogus nostrums and other false information about autism. And, you know, we know autism rates have risen mostly because of surveillance and reclassification of certain types of cognitive disorders on an autism spectrum. And social and cognitive disorders, and which is great. You know, people are doing very, very well to help identify these problems earlier in kids and get them the appropriate assistance. But there's always been this strange undercurrent of blaming the autism phenomenon on other things like vaccines. And the article really goes through, and I forgot to mention who the article was. It was by Stuart Weiss, and it was originally in Skeptical Inquirer. From False Cause to False Cure, Autism and the Rich and Famous. And it talks about how the folks who promoted bogus causes, like Jenny McCarthy and others, who were extremely vocal and extremely visible and extremely powerful, now have the ability, are now being used to promote false cures. And really, that's what the article is all about.
So one interesting thing about the story was actually the way it ended with them talking, or with the author talking about how celebrity influence on public opinion is actually quite mixed. And it has a lot to do with whether the celebrities happen to be popular and accepted at that point in time. And one of the other factors is media coverage. So if the media covers this, then another media outlet covers that. And then maybe you get a science publication that tries to respond to the celebrity's message. And then basically you get like this falling domino effect. So what I'm wondering is, how big of an influence do these people have looking back over the last two decades, would you say?
Yeah, right. And that's the interesting part about this that I thought was kind of required a little more head scratching, is that there's no guarantee that any one celebrity will be influential. So for instance, Jenny McCarthy, while some people found her extremely credible and she had a great traction for a long time, Oprah gave her a front and center megaphone back in the day, and she's kind of gone away. At the same time, back then, I was very critical of her. Actually, I used to tutor her sister, which was kind of cool. I used to tutor her sister. Her sister was played sports somewhere and at the university where I was a grad student, and so I got to help her out. And but long story short, the folks who are in these games, they are extremely influential with some people, but absolutely not with others. And I think that's where the article didn't quite cross all the T's and dot the I's for me, and that they didn't really go too deep into that. It just kind of, you know, mentions it didn't have sufficient analysis to talk about why. But I think it really has to do with who we trust. And it goes back to that whole argument in science communication. Is it that we, you know, me as a scientist, I trust certain people and be very specific about autism, for instance. But other folks really, who, especially those who have affected kids, are extremely likely to trust somebody who is confirming their biases, that this is an environmental issue, not a genetic issue. It's something caused by big business, not something that could have been through me, you know, that kind of thing. And so maybe there's a lot of psychological appeal there too.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Well, maybe we can explore that a little bit more, because that was one of the thoughts I had as I was reading this. And, you know, we've talked briefly about my mom on the show, specifically about the COVID vaccine. She forwarded me some email and some guy was calling the spike protein a bioweapon or what, I don't even remember the details. But that, I guess that's my question. Are there certain demographics that are going to see someone like Jenny McCarthy or not Ace Ventura, what's his real name?
Jim Carrey.
Yeah, Jim Carrey. Are there some people that are going to go, well, and maybe it's subconscious, but they're going to go, oh, I like his movies, so I'm going to listen to him. Is that the big problem? It's not that it's a widespread problem. It's that focused demographics that, say, raise kids, like parents, they're going to listen to these people.
Yeah, but there's many layers to that onion. I think that when you see a mother who is struggling with trying to sort out, you know, take care of her kid and do her best as a mother, which probably Jenny McCarthy was truly trying to do. You know, no doubt she loves her son, Evan, and that she was taking good care of him during that time and doing what she thought was best. But what a former Playboy model turned actress thinks is best is not necessarily what is best. But for a certain group of people who have empathy for her as a mother of an affected child, who has, you know, certain challenges, there's a lot of pull there and a lot of, you know, heart goes out to her kind of thing. And so they do trust her. And because she has some resources, she has a little bit better megaphone and gets a little bit better grip than others do.
Yeah, that's very true. Another thing I've noticed, and I'm not the first person to say this, but I have seen multiple times now that celebrities like this, or maybe activists who oppose vaccines, they're actually pretty thoughtful people, and they get really good at repeating their arguments and understanding what people are going to come at them with. And I think if you're a parent hearing that for the first time, it sounds really convincing. And one of the classic examples is, you know, the CDC's vaccine schedule is ridiculous. You know, you have to get all these shots before 2 years of age. And I could see, as a soon-to-be parent, why that would be appealing. You go, yeah, you know, why do they need 30 shots or however many are on the schedule now? Why do they need so many? Maybe we could just space them out. You know, like that has a certain level of plausibility to it. So do you think that contributes to this as well?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and it also, it just causes that fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And it's your child, so it's something important. And, you know, and that's why all these things tend to have a great deal of traction. It's that plus the other side of the equation, the physicians who say, just get the shot, you know, Paul Offit tells you, just get it. This is the way it works. It's not the same as someone who is the parent of an affected child. And that's why folks like Peter Hotez has a little more cred, because he's a parent of an autistic daughter, and he says a lot in this space. So it all depends on who you trust and how they earn your trust. And that's why these folks are especially problematic, because they're trustworthy because of those situations, but they also have a megaphone. They also have plenty of money. And those things together give them a little more pull than, say, Kevin and Cameron in their podcast. So that's why it's really important to consider celebrity information, which I completely disregard every time I can. But for most people, it does have some influence.
Yeah, I especially hate the ones where they tell me to vote. That makes me want to vomit.
Yeah.
Anyways, just a final thought. I obviously, the pandemic has been a disaster, and I'm not in any way saying this is a good thing, but maybe a silver lining is that so many people have accepted the vaccine. You know, like, the cases are dropping, the hospitalizations are dropping in most states. So maybe that's one of the positive takeaways. I mean, obviously we don't like the death that's occurred, but, you know, in other words, when people are forced to make a choice that truly affects their health and their safety, they go, you know, I'm just going to get the shot. And there's always going to be that remnant of people that won't, but maybe there's something we can take away from this last year.
Yeah. We're doing the experiment in real time, right? And that's really what this is that it's one thing to see a few cases of measles show up in California. This is a problem that came up and a problem that was solved by a vaccine. And the results are irrefutable. Yet there's still people who try to refute them. But I see this as a way that when I've looked at the anti-vax folks online now what they're doing is moving goalposts. And they're saying, well, you're going to have antibody-dependent enhancement popping up and all kinds of other problems. Just wait till there's another serotype coming along. You know, they've shifted their goal or their goalpost from, you know, vaccine will kill you and cause autism and all this stuff to, well, you just don't know the long-term effects. And as we've seen with, you know, GMOs, microwaves, in vitro fertilization, refrigerators, and every other breakthrough in history, the people come out screaming long-term effects. That's kind of means they're on the ropes and they got nothing else.
Yeah. Well, that's encouraging then. But let's move on. Let's talk. This is going to be the biggest scandalous story we've probably ever talked about, but what's up with this lab leak hypothesis that people are talking about?
Well, the reason I wanted to talk about this one and the reason it was important is because we really need to talk about what does it mean when scientists say something is plausible. And that's why I got excited about this article today, is that there was a report in 2020 came through the State Department in the Trump administration that said it was plausible that this was leaked from a Wuhan lab. Now, what does that mean when you say it's plausible? Well, some people say, aha, smoking gun, right? Really, all it means when it's plausible is that it's something that can happen mechanistically. It doesn't mean that it did, and it doesn't mean that it's probable. So it's the difference between plausibility and probability. And I always talk about this in my classes and say it's plausible that every molecule of oxygen in this room can move up into one corner just by random motion, and we all suffocate. It's true. It's plausible. Random motion means that they could all aggregate in one corner and we just all suffocate. Is it possible? Is it plausible? Yes. But is it probable? No. And because, you know, random motion of trillions of molecules or quadrillions of molecules are going to, you know, so you see the difference. So when you talk about what's happening with COVID-19 and the SARS-CoV-2 virus in Wuhan, there's really three big possibilities, right? And it was a naturally occurring variant that came from zoonotic transfer from an animal that was butchered in, you know, in a wet market. Okay, that's one. That it was a lab leak where they work on this thing at the Wuhan Institute, and it ended up in Wuhan. And there were people who were from the Institute who had a flu-like illness who were hospitalized, not just sick, hospitalized, right around the same time. So this may have been something that came out inadvertently. And the other one is that it was a bioweapon that was created by the Chinese to bring the world's economies to its knees, right? And those are the things that people talk about as the hypotheses. And you can take that middle one and say, here's, you know, they work on this thing in Wuhan, and they, you know, worked on gain of function testing in that laboratory. We know that. So it is a possibility that this is something that was created and walked out. It's plausible, but probably not possible. When experts look at the sequence, it doesn't appear that the sequence is a genetically engineered sequence. If it really was something that they were trying to demonstrate gain of function, they would have done it a little more elaborately and done it a little bit more precisely. Meaning there's other ways that there's things that suggest it was done by random chance, not by direction. And there was a really good This Week in Virology that discussed this. And I didn't want to go too deep into that. But in general, it doesn't appear as though it was something that was manufactured. So that's really working against the plausibility or the probability of lab leak as being a realistic outcome.
Yeah, well, thanks for the summary. There's a couple of things that I think are worth discussing without getting too deep into the genetics of it, because I think we'll just end up in the weeds and we won't solve anything. But this is a quote from that really well-known Science article now from mid-May, and they said, and this is 18 scientists, they're all virologists or geneticists, and so here's the quote. They say, "Furthermore, the two theories were not given balanced consideration by the World Health Organization joint study with China. Only 4 of the 313 pages of the report and its annexes address the possibility of a laboratory accident." So as a non-scientist looking at this from the outside, that raises flags for me. And I'm not saying that proves it was a bioweapon, but I get curious about that. That seems, I mean, it is unbalanced for sure, but that says to me, you know, we need to look deeper into this. And it seems like these scientists think the same thing. So what's your take on that?
And that's something that people are looking into. And I think that the idea of this being a lab leak is something that was, that is something that people take seriously and people are considering as a realm of possibility, even though it seems highly improbable. But you know, it's got the problem of too much scientists speak around it too. You know, people using very careful, conservative scientific language that leaves the door. There's not enough definitive language saying this is not possible. And with that, leaves the door open a crack for folks with a conspiratorial bend to bend the conspiracy. and so it really does make it more of a challenge.
Sure, sure. One, without getting too deep into the genetics here, I found a study from November of last year, or a commentary really, because they're just reviewing the science. But one of the things they pointed out is that you can do gain of function research for, you know, laudable goals to try to figure out how something might mutate naturally and then kill people. So, you know, maybe there's a reason to do the research, but you could do that kind of study without leaving a signature in the genome of the virus. And so because of that, you need to have access to the internal records at the virology lab, and you need people to cooperate with you. What do you think of that? Like, maybe, I guess the question is, maybe looking at the virus won't give you the smoking gun. You need, you know, to get behind the scenes, if you will. What do you think of that?
That's true. And you would need access to freezers and stocks of viruses and things like that to see if something would match. Yeah, if you wanted to specifically engineer something, yes, you could. It would look very different. But what if you just wanted to mutagenize something, just randomize it, just, and, you know, this is stuff my lab does all the time. We randomize DNA sequence and see how that affects things, knowing that sometime you're going to have a gain of function. And it's not going to look like an engineered situation. So, yes, if that's the kind of work they were doing, where they were randomizing sequence in DNA and then maybe testing different viral strains on animals, you know, that were randomized, or where certain positions in the viral genome were randomized or changed or different amino acids substituted, you know, that kind of thing could be very real. But at the same time, it takes evidence to prove that. And, you know, that's where, you know, the folks in Wuhan, you know, you have to put yourself in their shoes too. And here you have an Institute of Virology where you've been doing viral research. And do you really want to open up all your books and open up all your freezers to allow people who are pointing a finger at you to come in and start rooting around? It's kind of like giving all your emails to, you know, Gary Ruskin and saying, you know, I didn't do anything wrong. And he goes, well, let's just look through here. And, you know, they have a funny way of finding smoking guns where there really isn't.
Sure.
And so that's, I can understand the hesitancy of the Chinese government to allow full unfettered access.
Sure, sure. I've read through some of Dr. Fauci's emails, and there definitely isn't a smoking gun, but there are some, there are some curiosities, I would say, at least. And the reason I say that is because if you guys recall from early 2020, the media and the big tech companies were all on the same messaging, which was, this is a conspiracy theory. It's been debunked. There's a paper in Nature that says they would have engineered it differently, so on and so forth. So you guys all need to shut up, and we're going to ban you if you keep talking about this. But from reading those emails, and again, you didn't mention it by name, but there was a study in Science in 2015 saying that that virology lab was working on bat coronaviruses. So in other words, behind the scenes, people were aware that this research was going on and they were considering it. And then publicly, everyone else was being told, this is a conspiracy. And that, frankly, kind of pisses me off a little bit. So I'm totally sympathetic to what you're saying, that we can't prove it in either direction and we need to follow the data. But the censorship aspect of it, based on what we know now, is a little bit irritating, I think.
Yeah, I get that 100%. And I think that this has to go with the psychology of how you manage a pandemic. That back in the beginning, when this was all unfolding, you know, you remember, you know, how many times did we say on this podcast, they're building the plane as they're flying it. We don't know. We don't have data. And yet, trying to focus everybody on how do we solve the problem rather than, you know, what are the plausible ways that we can, that this started. And everybody wanted to blame somebody. And it wasn't a good time to point fingers. It was a time to point microscopes. And I think maybe that was part of the psychology. Let's eliminate the noise from this and get the politics out of it. And let's try to solve the problem.
Yeah, very, very, very good stuff, Kevin, always with the insights. Well, I guess we'll leave it there. You know, I guess the final thing I would say is, it seems like an open question, and I've seen a handful of bloggers and people in the science communication space still emphasizing that this is a conspiracy theory, even though you have very prominent experts coming out and saying, we need to look into this more. So that's the part that I find a bit frustrating still. It's like, you're telling me it's open, that, you know, you don't know for sure, but if you're on the other side from me, then you're a nutball, you know, that just doesn't work. But yeah, any final thoughts on that? And then we'll talk about why Greenpeace kind of sucks.
No, let's talk about why Greenpeace kind of sucks.
All right. Go into it. What's up with the story?
Yeah, so this story is a follow-through on something we talked about on this podcast over a year ago. And there's been a plague of locusts in the Horn of Africa. So Somalia, Ethiopia, some of the countries in this region have had a tremendous problem with swarms of locusts, even in the Kenya. And we talked about it last year, and you would see these signatures on radar that would look like swarms of locusts that were 35 kilometers in across, and that they would land in a field and eat in a few minutes enough to take away food for a million people. I mean, it was ridiculous, the numbers that we read. And one of the solutions was to equip their meager resources, and like Kenya has 5 pesticide spraying planes, was to allow them to use conventional pesticides to spray these gigantic swarms. And folks like Greenpeace were saying, well, no, not so fast. And we reported that people were running, that the farmers who had their fields being decimated by locusts were running through the fields with whistles and waving shirts. I mean, this is all they had. And Greenpeace came aboard and said, no pesticides. Well, here we are a year later, and it turns out that farmers are farmers, and farmers will do what it takes to get the job done. And so between farmers and the agricultural ministries of these countries, they've now started to deploy insecticides and control the insects with appropriate chemistry. And, you know, Greenpeace has said, well, no, you have to use the biopesticides, these, you know, less effective alternatives. And the ag ministries of countries of starving people said, no, we're not going to do it. So, you know, nuts to you, Greenpeace.
Yeah, that's one word you could use. So maybe this is an extension of the trend we've talked about, where you have these anti-pesticide and anti-GMO groups slowly losing their influence. It's happened more rapidly in the United States, but we're seeing Europe now start to consider allowing some uses of gene editing in agriculture. Same thing in the UK. And a lot of developing countries have already walked away from a lot of this rhetoric that they used to find very convincing. So what do you think? Is this maybe another example of these countries just giving the double birds to to this activism mentality? And they're like, look, our people are hungry and they're dying, so just shut up, you know?
Well, it's also been that Greenpeace has been perennially wrong. You know, the same countries have people who have suffered because of no golden rice, you know, and here you have some folks that are so committed to standing in the way of technology, even if it can be used appropriately and used safely and can be used to help people who are food insecure. And, yeah, special place in hell for them, you know, as far as I'm concerned. But this is a, you know, I think they do start, that we do start to see fatigue of towards chemistry and towards genetics as the problems become insurmountable. And where people who, you know, I know people who will say, I, you know, use only organic pesticides in my garden, organic fertilizer. You know, until it hits the fan and you got a problem you can't control with it, they go, okay, fine, we're going to spray a little Malathion, you know, clear this up. You know, but it's because at the end of the day, if you don't have a crop, you're toast. And especially in places in the world where food security is really an issue, they said something like 42 million people have become food insecure because of the swarms of locusts. Not to mention the smallholder farmers who can't sell a crop, you know, and now have to find alternative means to fund their own homes. So this is really a problem. And I'm glad that they're finally standing up to the bullies of activists from the West.
You know, I think it might have been our first or second episode of this show where we talked about this. And at the time, they didn't have access to these chemicals. They were still trying to acquire enough stock of them, I think, was the issue. But they were burning tires. They were going into their fields with whistles to try to scare. Yeah. You know, I mean, this is outrageous, right? I mean, we have the tools to clamp down on this. But the reason I ask about that is I think the ecologist Patrick Moore, who you've had on your podcast and who, according to some people, has gone a little off into left field. but mm-hmm. I think one of the points that he made about why he left Greenpeace is that they just started inventing crises, or they would turn real problems into mountains, you know, from molehills, really. And he just got fed up with that kind of activism trying to perpetuate activism. Do I have that right? Is that basically what he was saying about them?
Yeah, that's what it really was, is that they took their eye off the ball. It wasn't about science anymore. It was about fundraising and about pet projects that they wanted to create change in. And whether it's political, it becomes more political, right, than scientific. And we know that whenever that happens, things are not working out so hot.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, good news is people aren't listening to them as much. So maybe they still have lots of money, but nobody cares.
Yeah.
Who you following on Twitter?
Well, I think a good follow is Dr. Amy Maxman. And that's at Amy, M-A-X-M-E-N. She has been a very good reporter through the pandemic, but also very good with other issues in biology. And I always appreciate her posts. They come up quite a bit. So glad to, I think that's a really good follow.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good one. And I don't know. I don't know if that was motivated by her recent article about the lab leak thing, but
yeah, it was, I saw, okay. I thought that was quite good. So
yeah. Yeah. That was a good story. And again, mine's motivated by the same thing, but I'm going to recommend people follow a scientist named Alina Chan. She's a postdoctoral researcher at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. And she's been, I guess, a little more aggressively pushing for an investigation into the lab leak theory. And she gets more into the genetics of it. But I think it's useful, even if you don't accept that idea, that you just look at what other people on the other side are saying. And she's credible. You know, it's not Prison Planet with Alex Jones. It's, you know, bona fide scientists. So, but anyways, her handle is at AYJ Chan. So give her a follow. And that's going to do it for us this week. Thank you guys so much. Follow us as well at Cam J English, at Kevin Folta. We will see you next week. Give us stars and reviews and share the podcast with your friends when it comes out. And thank you so much. See you next time.